Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public media. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. It's been almost 6 months since a mob of thousands of people broke through police barriers and stormed the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. as Congress met to count Electoral College votes in the 2020 presidential election. Almost 500 people have been charged in connection with the insurrection, facing a variety of charges ranging from entering restricted grounds, assault, to using a deadly weapon. About one out of every 10 people who've been charged are from Florida, according to an analysis by USA Today. More people from Florida than almost any other state face criminal charges from the January 6th riot. Why? Why has the Sunshine State emerged as a crucible of political conspiracy and extremism? More people associated with two extremist groups who face charges call Florida home than any other state. Governor Ron DeSantis was asked again this week if he thinks the 2020 election was not legitimate.
Do you believe that the 2020 presidential election was rigged?
I think we had the best run election in this state that we probably ever have. I'm proud of what they did. And look, I mean, obviously we had to do some things at the state level. I mean, I had to make some changes when I first came into office. I think those were long overdue changes. I think they were effective changes.
The governor did not directly answer the question. How does the rhetoric around elections and the refusal by some to call the 2020 presidential election legitimate affect political extremism and confidence in politics here in Florida? 305-995-1800. This is where we start our conversation this week throughout the Sunshine State. 305-995-1800. You can also join us on social media. Find us on Twitter at Florida Roundup is our handle. Zach Anderson is with us now, political editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, which was behind the analysis of those charged with the taking part in the insurrection on January 6th. Zach, welcome back to Florida Public Radio. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Tell us about some of the individuals. Who are these Floridians facing charges because of the January 6th insurrection?
Well, they really come from all over the state, from the panhandle down to, the Miami area. And over here on the West Coast and on the East Coast of Florida, you see, people of different backgrounds. You know, there was a rabbi, actually, who was arrested and is facing charges. There was a car dealership manager. There was a chiropractor, somebody who was a convenience store worker. But there are a few things that tie them together. Most of them are men. Only five women from Florida were arrested. And while there were two 21-year-olds and one person who was 67, most of them are in their 30s and 40s. The average age is 41. A lot of them, are registered Republicans. A lot of them were captured on video storming the Capitol in pro-Trump gear. So these are seem to be, pretty conservative leaning individuals. And a large number of them were actually associated with two extremist groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. Florida actually had the most Proud Boys and the most Oath Keepers arrested of any state. So about a quarter of the people arrested were associated with these two extremist groups.
I'll ask you about those extremist groups and their presence in Florida in a moment. But Zach, what are the charges these Floridians face in connection to their alleged activities on Capitol Hill January 6th?
They face a lot of different charges. These federal charges include, disrupting the activity of Congress, unauthorized, some of them are more along the lines of just, being in an unauthorized area or disrupting. But some of them are also charged with violence. At least nine of them that we counted had actually been charged with assaulting a police officer. One of them, the most recent, actually allegedly jammed a flagpole into an officer's chest until the officer stumbled backward and hit his head on a statue. So, another one, a Proud Boy from the Naples area, is accused of pepper spraying a line of officers. And then there are conspiracy charges against the Oath Keepers that basically alleging that engaged in a conspiracy to disrupt the election and disrupt the counting of the Electoral College votes and coordinated the Oath Keepers in Florida with other Oath Keepers around the country to disrupt the vote count.
The Oath Keepers, one of the two extremist groups that have been identified with a presence in Florida of their alleged members being charged with some activities on Capitol Hill on January 6th during the insurrection. What kind of presence does the Oath Keepers specifically have here in Florida?
You know, I don't know that this was a group that had a really high profile in Florida before this event. That they started in, I spoke to a professor named Sam Jackson, who actually wrote a book about the Oath Keepers. They're a group that only started in 2009. They're sort of an anti-government militia group. You know, they started, you know, with some activities related to protesting government actions that they thought were overreach. But since Trump was elected, this professor told me that they've swung very strongly pro-Trump, and that more of the group's activities have been sort of clashes with left-leaning Americans. And, you know, their presence in Florida, you know, this was really, you know, it's hard to say. The professor that I talked to did not, you know, kind of have a whole lot of information on how big of a presence they have. But seven of them, seven Oath Keepers, have been arrested from Florida in connection, you know, with the Capitol siege. And, you know, that's almost half of the Oath Keepers that have been arrested. So, you know, they do seem to have a presence in the state for sure.
Your phone calls with Zach Anderson, political editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, coming up in just moments, 305-995-1800. Zach's publication did an analysis of those that have been charged with crimes because of the January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and about 10% of those charged nationwide are Floridians. Florida tied with Texas for the most number of residents who have been accused of crimes related to the January 6th riot on Capitol Hill. One of the other extremist groups that has been identified here, the Proud Boys, and the Southern Poverty Law Center identifies six Proud Boy chapters in Florida: Miami, Tampa, Orlando, Sarasota, where you are, Zach, DeLand, and Milton in the Panhandle. Tell us about the presence of the Proud Boys.
Yeah, the Proud Boys, you know, they had a pretty active presence in this storming of the Capitol. There's been about, I think, two dozen of them nationwide who have been arrested so far. You know, they've been accused of trying coordinating together to march on the Capitol and you know, lay siege to the Capitol. You know, they're probably the most high profile, you know, far right group that has been involved in this. And they undoubtedly have a very strong presence in Florida. The group's national leader is a Floridian. You know, they've been visible in the state for a number of years now. I actually covered a political rally in Bradenton recently that was headlined by Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, and Roger Stone, the political advisor. And there was a big group of Proud Boys at that rally just a few months ago who actually came up on stage. So they've been very visible and active in the state, and they were very active in the storming of the Capitol.
We were talking about the storming of the Capitol and the role Floridians have been accused of playing, charged with crimes. About 10% of those almost 500 people who have been charged are from Florida. Zach Anderson is the political editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Your calls at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. In Lakeland, JC is up first. JC, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hey, thanks, guys, for taking my call. I'm a business owner in Lakeland, and first of all, happy Juneteenth, and prior Republican member of the prior Republican member of that party until recently. But what I'm calling about is because what happened today, when I was taking out my recycling My neighbor came over across the street and said, hey, I would like to talk to you. And can I ask you, did you have a white truck casing the neighborhood around my house last night? Can you check your cameras to see if you've got a tag or that truck described it to me? And I said, well, what's going on? He says, well, my wife's relative is a Trump supporter, QAnon person, all that. And we've been at odds. In discussions, and now he's casing the house and was seen by another neighbor looking over the fence into their backyard and was asking me if I had him on camera. And so we're actually going to be meeting this afternoon to have a discussion about how we can help better support security and around our own houses. Guys, this is against our fellow Americans. This isn't against some foreign entity invading our country. These are our fellow Americans. Yeah. And all this, I feel, and he feels, has been incited by wrongful leadership in America, and that's why I left the Republican Party. This is clear and obvious, unless you are, you know, skewed by you know, a hateful rhetoric and direction.
Yeah,
and I feel like a lot of our neighbors, a lot of our people in America, are falling for this and are taking this on. And we were actually going to be meeting about this. I'm going to be checking my cameras. I haven't had time to do that for him.
Yeah. You know? JC, I appreciate you sharing that story, and best of luck with your neighbors and with your family members there in Lakeland, and for sharing that that real story there for one family. Scott in Orlando, you're up next. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi. Well, thank you very much for taking my call, and happy June 13th. Just a point of interest. Look, if free and fair elections can't be agreed upon as part of the foil of and the responsibility of the secretaries of state, who are encumbered by each state to carry out the duties that they are told to oversee their free and fair elections. If we cannot believe that those elections are free and fair, we do not no longer have a democracy. So everything else that we argue is fairly moot, and we're going to be reduced to a bunch of tribes going after each other's necks. And let's say, who does that serve? It doesn't serve Americans. So my call is out to anybody who thinks that the 2020 election was not free and fair. Go to your Secretary of State. Or if you don't think the Pennsylvania election was free and fair, go to the Pennsylvania Secretary of State's office. Ask for the report. Ask for all of the anomalies with the voting, irregular voting. And you will see and identify that statistically they were carried out as free and fair. And as a sidebar to that, 2020 was probably the most supervised election in our entire history. There was so much at risk and so much on the table, and there were so many eyes on the prize. You know, it's immediately clear to me that there could be no sleight of hand without somebody being able to stand up and saying, this is exactly what happened.
Scott, I appreciate you lending your voice there. The dozens and dozens and dozens of court challenges that Republicans and the Trump administration and the president's campaign filed in many states failed to muster any kind of legitimacy in a court of law. Zach Anderson, the political editor with the Sarasota Herald Tribune, what about politics here? Talk to us about rhetoric a little bit. I played the clip of Politico reporter Gary Fineout this week asking the governor during a roundtable whether or not he believed the 2020 presidential election was rigged, and he did not directly answer the question.
Yeah, you know, this is continuing to be a really hot button political issue. You know, one reason that was given to me by a professor who focuses on extremism for why Florida, you know, maybe tied, one reason that Florida is tied for the most number of arrests related to the storming of the Capitol is, you know, potentially the state's demographics, its sort of conservative political bent. I mean, Florida is the third largest state in the country, so it makes sense that there would be a lot of arrests from the state. And also, you know, it's closer to Washington, D.C. than states like California, other large states. But still, it had more arrests. You know, when you factor in it, the proportion of Florida's arrests is greater than its proportion to the population of the country. And this professor said, well, you know, it is a conservative state. You know, it's a state that's changing, has a lot of changing demographics, and that can breed conflict. You know, and it's also worth noting that, you know, the elected officials in the state have not, you know, have not challenged the president's rhetoric. They've largely stood behind the president as he, called on his followers to, quote, stop the steal. You know, that as he continued to stoke these unfounded election fraud complaints, and that, you know, may have played a role in people, you know, kind of, you know, getting worked up about all of this, if your state leaders aren't, you know, tamping that down.
And it's already seeping into the 2022 gubernatorial election. The Democratic hopeful Charlie Crist today tweeting out, quote, I'm calling on Governor Ron DeSantis to protect our democracy by ordering a nonpartisan investigation of Florida's outsized role in the Capitol insurrection. What could you tell us about the former governor, now Congressman Crist's efforts, and what kind of reception is that likely to get in Tallahassee?
Yeah, I was actually at Congressman Crist's press conference today. You know, and he said that that basically he thinks that DeSantis should issue an executive order creating a bipartisan commission in Florida to investigate the state's ties to January 6th. I think that's probably dead on arrival with the governor's office, obviously. There's some politics involved here. Crist is running against DeSantis. He has to get through a primary first, right. But he wants to run against DeSantis. So, he's trying to put the spotlight on this issue and bring some attention to it.
Let me squeeze in one more call here. Donita in West Palm Beach, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio now.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm very concerned as a taxpayer, a business owner, a Black woman, a mother, a grandmother, to see what's happening in the state of Florida. This impacts the whole state and eventually will impact the world, nationally, worldwide. This mentality of the Proud Boys that has a large group here in the state of Florida, we cannot continue to accept this type of behavior and mentality. They need to be charged criminally for sedition and for all of their actions at January 6th insurrection in Washington, D.C. If the governor continues to stay silent and refuse to answer questions and acknowledge these groups as terrorist groups, then we have a problem. And at the end of the day, the governor, the senators, the congressmen, the representatives, our legislators, all have a cost to bear. And if they stay silent, they are complicit.
Donita, I appreciate you lending your voice and perspective there from West Palm Beach to our conversation, an important one to hear. Zach Anderson, about 30 seconds left or so. Is the investigation into the January 6th insurrection over? Have all those who authorities want to charge been charged?
No, I believe that the FBI director said this week that there's still, the likelihood of a lot more charges here. So I think that, this is ongoing, even the investigation into the Oath Keepers. I think there's still some unnamed people who they've been looking at. There was a bunch of arrests a few weeks ago in Florida, and I would expect more going forward.
Zach Anderson, political editor with the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Zach, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program, 4 of the 10 fastest growing areas in the country, right here in Florida. That's still to come. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. The Fort Myers area, Punta Gorda, Lakeland, the Villages, 4 of the 8 fastest growing areas in the country last year, according to new Census Bureau data out recently. And the fastest growing among them, the fastest growing in the entire country, the Villages in Central Florida.
The Villages is like being on vacation every day.
The Disney World for retirees.
It is like going off to college.
You come here to live. You don't come here to pass away.
That's from the documentary Some Kind of Heaven, which goes behind the projected utopia of that retirement community. The village's population grew by 4% last year. It's the fastest growing area over the past decade. Almost 50% more people calling the village's home now compared to 10 years ago. The population has almost tripled since the beginning of this century. Florida's past and future has been built around growth, more people crowding onto the peninsula and the panhandle. What's happening in the villages, Cape Coral, Lakeland, it's a familiar story for Florida, population pressuring the environment. So who should pay for the price of more people? The roads, fire stations, police stations, schools. It's all necessary as Florida keeps growing. If you live or work, visit these fast-growing areas. How are they changing? What's the balance between the impact and economic growth? 305-995-1800 to share your experiences with us. 305-995-1800. You can also find us on social media at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Joe Burns is with us, covers the villages for our partner station in Central Florida, WMFV. Joe, welcome back to the program. This area has been the fastest growing area. It's been on this list for years. Why? What's fueling the growth?
Well, it's people moving in. They're moving in from all over the country. And so last year, an estimated 7,087 people moved into Sumter County, which is the metropolitan statistical area for the villages.
What's attracting them?
Oh, it's the lifestyle. This is a wonderful retirement lifestyle. It's featured in that movie that you made reference to, some Kind of Heaven. There's another movie too, The Bubble, that looks at the unique lifestyle of the villages. As they say, it's like Disney World for retirees.
Yeah. So describe that. That lifestyle, and also describe the place, because the villages as a proper name, as a proper place, is plural, and it's not really a singular place, is it?
Well, it sells itself as it is the largest age-restricted community in the nation. And it is a place in that sense. I mean, the Census Bureau considers it a place.
Okay.
But it actually is in three separate counties and includes 13 different districts and a ton of little villages, as they call them. You know, there'll be a village of this and a village of that. Yeah. And a lot of the villagers will move from one place to the other in their time at the villages. They'll maybe have three different houses.
So this kind of wicked growth that the villages has experienced, not just during the pandemic year of 2020, not just even over the past decade, but as I mentioned, a tripling of its population since the year 2000. What has that growth meant for local services? Have local services infrastructure kept up?
Well, they're trying to. And one of the big questions is who is going to pay for it?
Yeah.
One of the most recent issues in the villages has to do with ambulance service. And especially during the pandemic, this year during the pandemic, there were some delays in response times for ambulances. And that's raised a big question about what changes need to be made to address ambulance service. For obviously, it's really important for that community, which is has an older population. So roads, especially, and now ambulance service and healthcare, all of these issues are important and they're complicated.
Complicated, and they can be increasingly expensive as more and more people pressure those kind of human-made systems, and also pressuring the natural environment there in Central Florida. We're talking about population growth in the villages, the fastest growing metropolitan area in the United States in 2020. In fact, Florida had four of the top eight fastest growing metropolitan areas in America last year, even with the pandemic. 305-995-1800. We'd love to hear from you if you live or work or visit some of these areas, Punta Gorda, the Fort Myers area, Lakeland, and the villages, 305-995-1800. Joe Burns with WMFE, our member station in Orlando, is with us. Joe covers the villages. Jane West joins our conversation now. Jane is Policy and Planning Director for 1000 Friends of Florida. Jane, welcome to the program. Thanks for sharing your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have called the villages, quote, Exhibit A of a place where growth has not been paying for itself, end quote. Explain.
Right. Well, basically, it hasn't been able to pay for its explosive growth. If growth paid for itself, Sumter County would be swimming in cash right now. And instead, the only thing that's swimming in cash in that area is the village's developer. So that's the problem that we're seeing. We are seeing the inability for this development to pay for the requisite capital infrastructure that is required with this kind of sprawling growth.
And where do you lie blame for that? Is the property tax rate too low? Is the property assessment system too slow to capture this kind of development? Tell us where 1000 Friends of Florida lies blame for that.
Well, certainly it lies with the developer. We have the multiple abilities here in the state of Florida to pay for infrastructure, right? So we can raise taxes, we can impose impact fees when a developer comes to town, and that is what should have happened here at the villages, right? So basically, we impose impact fees. It's a one-time kind of user fee that a developer pays to pay for things that Joe was mentioning, things like road expansion and fire safety. That one-time fee needs to keep up with the actual increased cost of that infrastructure. And that's where the villages is falling short. So for example, the current impact fee at the villages is $972, but an impact fee study done back in 2019 showed that the actual impact is $2,430. Wow. So, you know, there's a huge discrepancy there. And so what ends up happening when there's that shortfall, the local governments are burdened with that shortfall in their revenue.
Yeah.
And we saw in Sumter County that they had to raise back in 2019 their property taxes by 25% in order to cover that gap.
And Joe, the Sumter County also tried to increase those impact fees for a time, but was turned back because of state legislation, right?
Absolutely. So what happened is, surprisingly, the homeowners in the villages didn't like paying 25% more in property taxes.
Yes.
So what did they do about it? Well, they turned three commissioners out. The three commissioners who were up for re-election all got turned out. The big issue, I don't like my property taxes being increased by 25%. So the new commissioners come in and they want to shift more of the burden for road construction to the developer, to the new homes that are coming in, instead of having the existing homeowners pay for them. They did increase the impact fees for roads by 75%. But their own legislator for the villages, Brett Haig, co-sponsored a bill that capped impact fee increases to 12.5% a year,
right,
and retroactively applied it so that the increase that the commissioners had made was erased. Mm-hmm. They're now faced with a decision of, well, what are we going to do now? But that's what happened.
And financial disclosures for that representative have found that... Well, go ahead and finish that, Joe.
Yes, he works with the villages and earned $350,000 from the villages in 2020.
Yeah, we're talking about population growth, the pressures that people are putting on the environment, who pays for the necessary infrastructure for Florida to continue to be fueled by new residents. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. In St. Augustine, Emily is up next. Emily, thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Hi, yeah. They're talking about environmental pressures, and I live in St. Augustine. So environmental pressures is one thing, but also historic preservation is another. And St. Augustine is a tourist trap, and we need to keep up with historic preservation as well as building homes.
Mm-hmm.
And if residents want to live in a place as old as St. Augustine, they need to be able to pay the property tax. It's not like I don't know how to describe it. You know, if you want to live somewhere, you have to be willing to pay the property tax. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Yeah. So your message to those folks in the villages that voted out commissioners that supported a higher property tax would be what?
You know, you're living in a place like Florida. You are living in a environmentally diverse environment, a historically diverse environment, and you need to be able to pay upkeep so future generations can enjoy this state.
Yeah. Emily, I appreciate you sharing that perspective from historic St. Augustine, right? we're going from the oldest St. Augustine to some of the newest communities, the villages and others, talking about population growth and pressures on the region. Jose in Miami, you're up next. Go ahead, Jose. You're on the radio.
Yes, I've been in Miami and then Gainesville for a while, then back to Miami since 1967. And I have to tell you, I mean, everybody will tell you that's been here that long, that hasn't left, that this is grossly overcrowded. It's just very overcrowded. Not just Miami. I assume the villages. They're just, from my perspective, it would be a horrible place to live. But just crowded.
Yeah.
We're crowded. You can't go to the beach. You can't drive.
Jose, I'm speaking to you as a fellow South Floridian. It is crowded. There's no doubt about it. In fact, the last Census Bureau, Jane, I think, had, 20 million people calling Florida home now. And as we've seen with this, with the pandemic over the past year, the lure of Florida, the sunshine, the weather, the no income tax, no state income tax, that continues to bring people in.
Yeah, absolutely. The no income tax is a big draw for people coming to Florida. But unfortunately, we all have to pay for this expansive growth. And the limitation on impact fees, that was House Bill 337 that Governor DeSantis just signed into law, really is tying the hands of local government in their ability to raise the necessary revenue to pay for this explosive growth. So without the ability to raise the impact fees and short of raising property taxes, what is left? What is left is a reduction in those public services. So that's what's going to end up happening. You're going to have overcrowded, bad roads, poor schools. So we have to pay for these services, and the impact fees was a mechanism to do that. So it was really unfortunate that Governor DeSantis signed that bill into law.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Jane West is the Policy and Planning Director for 1000 Friends of Florida. Joe Burns is with us, the Villages reporter for our station in Central Florida, WMFV, talking about impact fees, development growth, population growth, the pressures on the local environment and the built-up environment. Jane, I wanted to ask you, Governor Rick Scott in 2011 signed a bill that mostly got rid of state oversight for local planning decisions. Supporters argued that it limited state control over local decisions. Why wasn't local control over the last decade a better thing? Or has it been a good thing?
Well, it really hasn't. The state oversight that the Department of Community Affairs afforded before Governor Scott dismantled that entire agency and instead renamed it the Department of Economic Opportunity and basically took all of the teeth away from that agency as well in terms of growth management was really catastrophic. We have seen just unchecked growth here in Florida without that sort of regional coordination that is so badly needed. Yeah. So unfortunately, local governments are now being stripped away of their ability to pay for that growth as well. So we are just getting hit all over the place. We need growth management in Florida to come back.
Joe, you mentioned the villages stretches over a number of counties. It is in one metropolitan statistical area as far as the Census Bureau is concerned, but lots of different local governments are involved with what gets built, where it gets built, how it gets built. Does it all get tied together in your estimation for the villages? How does that get coordinated or work together?
Well, the villages plans its growth, and then it works with the individual cities and counties to make that happen. And the new growth is occurring in the city of Wildwood. The city of Wildwood, as it's annexed in this area that the villages is growing into. Yeah. And then there's an area that's annexed into Leesburg as well. Mm-hmm. So they work with the city, and then they also have to work with the county for the growth they're doing. In Sumter County, basically, the county has agreed to pay for the regional roads. And that's where a lot of this issue that that Jane and I were talking about comes in.
Yeah. Let's squeeze in one more call here. Lake Worth Beach in South Florida. Jenny is on line 8. Jenny, thanks for calling and listening. You're on the radio.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to tell you a story about my little town, Lake Worth Beach.
I've got about 45 seconds, Jenny, so
okay,
I want to hear it.
Okay. Well, we're pretty much tied to some previously approved or almost approved developments. We have a new commission advocating smart growth, and we need some growth to be economically viable. But these developments aren't going to pay for themselves and the services that they need. This is just echoing what two of the previous speakers said.
Yeah.
It's a dilemma. We want growth. We want some smart growth so that the burden doesn't fall on the taxpayers.
Yeah. Jenny in Lake Worth Beach, I appreciate that. To Jane, lots of different kind of regional, local answers and how these different areas are approaching this issue of growth. And Joe, to an earlier point that you made, it winds up being expressed at the ballot box oftentimes. Thanks to both of you for sharing your expertise. Jane West, the Policy and Planning Director of 1000 Friends of Florida. Jane, appreciate your time. And Joe Burns, always great to have you on and sharing your reporting from the villages from our station WMFE in Orlando. Still to come, why are so many manatees in Florida dying? Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. This has been a deadly year for one of the favorite symbols of Florida. Now, while alligators may be the state's best-known animal image, the manatee has to be one of its most beloved, right? Wherever the plant-eating underwater mammals gather, you always find people staring, pointing, waiting for those manatee whiskers to break the surface for a breath. Well, so far this year, the state's tally of dead manatees already stretches over 24 pages, according to a state agency. 800 manatees have died, almost three times the average number by this time in a year. From Julington Creek in Jacksonville to Old Tampa Bay to the Indian River Lagoon along the Atlantic coast. Why is this year so deadly for manatees? 305-995-1800 if you fish among the manatees, if you walk along the dock looking for manatees in season. 305-995-1800 or at Florida Roundup. Amy Green is the environmental reporter at WMFE, our member station in Orlando. So, Amy, how bad is it? These statistics sound pretty bad.
This is a crisis situation. You mentioned 800 manatee deaths so far this year in Florida. Just to give that number a little context, last year in 2020, we had 321 deaths, and we're almost halfway through 2021. And so it's just a heart-wrenching jump in the numbers. And the overwhelming majority of the deaths are taking place in Brevard County, which, of course, is home to the Indian River Lagoon, yep, which has been a very troubled waterway for many years.
Yeah. So what have wildlife officials been able to list among the causes of death, the extra causes of death? We know that watercraft injuries are always, unfortunately, part of the fatality of manatees, but you know, how does that compare, and what are some of these other causes?
Right. Well, in the Indian River Lagoon, what's happening is just a widespread loss of seagrass, which is the manatees' primary food, you have parts of the Indian River Lagoon where as much as 90% of the seagrass is gone. Mm. And you know, again, this is a crisis situation because it leaves the manatees with nothing to eat. But seagrass is the foundation of an ecosystem like that. It's also where minnows, it's a nursery to minnows, which are eaten by bigger fish. And so, you know, in some ways, the manatee situation is only the tip of the iceberg for what we're seeing in the Indian River Lagoon.
Wow. Amy, stick with us. Amy Green, environmental reporter for our member station in Orlando, WMFE. We're talking about the really unprecedented number of manatee deaths already this year in Florida. Patrick Rose joins us, aquatic biologist and executive director of Save the Manatee Club. Patrick, thanks for sharing your time today. What are some of the conditions that are contributing to these deaths, to the unprecedented number of manatee deaths we're seeing?
Well, it's a good follow-up to the segment you just had. By Florida failing to grow sustainably, we're throwing away our future for the excesses of today. And those excesses also come in the form of nutrient pollution from our wastewater that makes its way into systems like the Indian River Lagoon with pretty tragic consequences. The excess nitrogen and phosphorus that's entered the system over decades has led to algal blooms, a series of them, the first really super bloom happening in 2011, but subsequently many other blooms and brown tide among them that has really devastated, as Amy said, the seagrass within the 156-mile-long Indian River lagoons, especially bad in the northern end, where the shading from the continued repeated algal blooms has killed the seagrass. Even the nutrients within those seagrasses themselves then are released to the system, which leads to further collapse. And what once was the, you know, probably the most abundant food resources for manatees in the Banana River, Indian River, Mosquito Lagoon is really almost all gone. And so we have about 2,000 manatees that depend on, especially in the wintertime, to the warm water power plant in Titusville. And so those animals were forced to choose between dying from cold stress or going much, much farther to find food. Both were sort of lethal consequences.
Amy Green, you've written a book about water in the Everglades, Moving Water, the Everglades and Big Sugar. How do the algae blooms that Florida in this manatee area experiencing this year, how does it compare to years past?
Right. So these algae blooms in the Indian River Lagoon and the northern end of the lagoon are a little different than what we've seen in other parts of the state where we've seen, you know, this very terrible toxic algae, the blue-green algae and red tide. What's happening in the Indian River Lagoon is when these harmful algae blooms take over, it clouds the water and it prevents sunlight from penetrating the water and getting to the seagrass, and it prevents photosynthesis and things like that. And as Patrick Rose just explained, as the seagrass dies, you know, it releases more nutrients, which can feed more harmful algae blooms, and you just get into this cycle.
Yeah. And so, Patrick, I'm wondering, we've seen algae blooms in the past, but not necessarily the level of manatee deaths. Is it better data collection? Why the difference?
Well, it's the buildup. So the continued loss of seagrass forage and getting down to such low numbers, as much as 95% of the seagrass is lost. And so in the wintertime, the manatees have to stay close to the power plant to stay warm.
Yeah.
So they didn't have the ability to forage farther. COVID also complicated the situation. So as things were getting worse, and there were even scheduled health assessments to learn more about how manatees were doing, some really key work didn't happen because of COVID. And that let it sort of creep up a little more. It's not an excuse. And for years, we'd been warning the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that the situation was declining dramatically and that we could be facing these kinds of consequences. But they had been more interested in downlisting manatees in 2017 and kind of ignoring these really serious threats. And so with COVID, that just, you know, made it a little worse, because some work that would have happened otherwise to have given more of a pre-warning to this didn't happen. But really, it's the failures over many years that have led to this such loss of food. that in the history of the work we've done with manatees, the first time we've had mass mortality that's associated with forage or starvation and malnutrition. Yeah.
Let me remind folks that they are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We're talking about the unprecedented number of manatee deaths already this year in Florida, 800 and climbing, according to the latest state data. Francis is in Fort Pierce. Francis, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hi, yes. Is there any science or efforts to reseeding seagrass? Because I would absolutely volunteer for doing that to help.
Great question, Francis. Yeah, how does new seagrass get grown, Patrick?
Yes, so in Fort Pierce in particular, there's actually a scheduled replanting because it's fairly near the inlet there. And so that's an area that's a reasonable target for the very near future for some replanting. But much of the Indian River Lagoon and farther north, it's not even recovered enough yet from a water quality standpoint. So we've got to cure the sort of original problem, which was the shading of the seagrasses and promote the water quality improvements that are going to allow that. At that point in time, we'll have some natural recurrence of seagrass, but also there are plans being looked at to replant seagrasses. More immediately, the tributaries that lead into the Indian River Lagoon are scheduled through this summer and right through the winter for planting of freshwater vegetation, vallisneria or eelgrass, and that will help. We're also going to have to monitor really how well the system grows over the summer, but it's not expected that there would be enough regrowth, and we could actually be facing a worse situation this winter because so much has been lost.
I wanted to ask Amy about kind of the shorter term weather forecast, and you know, we're in storm season, we're in the rainy season. What that could mean for some of these areas where water quality has been affecting the seagrass, and that's been obviously impacting the manatee population.
Right. Well, just to quickly, back to the caller's question, another effort that is underway in the Indian River Lagoon is oysters. Oysters are natural. They naturally filter the water. And so that's why a lot of groups are getting together to, try to introduce more oysters to the Indian River Lagoon to filter the water of these nutrients. And to your question, Tom, certainly, during the rainy season, the rainfall can help flush, these waterways. The problem with the northern end of the Indian River Lagoon is that it doesn't have a lot of give and take with the Atlantic Ocean like the southern lagoon does at the inlet there by Fort Pierce. And so so that is a challenge in the northern lagoon. What flows into the lagoon stays in the lagoon. And there's been talk about opening an inlet there, but that's a complicated issue. And that's just a unique challenge to the northern end of the lagoon.
Well, the manatee has that beloved space in so many Floridians' hearts as this gentle giant floating, and just all of us who've seen one can still picture watching those whiskers break the surface for a little gulp of air. Amy Green, the environmental reporter at our member station in Orlando, WMFE, author of Moving Water, The Everglades and Big Sugar. Patrick Rose also has been our guest, aquatic biologist and executive director of Save the Manatee Club. Patrick, Amy, thanks for spending your time with us.
You bet.
Welcome.
That is our program on this Friday. It is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Perdomo are the producers. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations and our Technical Director is Peter Maris. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. For my co-host Melissa Ross, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and have a happy Father's Day.